Welcome to the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Here are your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub.
All right, welcome to Legally Sound Smart Business. This is Nasser Pasha.
And this is Matt Staub.
And we are ready to go. This is where we answer some of your business legal questions and also go over some business legal articles as well and put in our legal twist. This week, we have a guest coming up. He's not in studio, Mr. Tyler Jensen from Startup Garage, and we'll get him on later in the program. Let's get started.
All right. So we actually mentioned this last week that pretty soon we'd have to start talking about patent trolls.
Yeah.
And guess what? That's the first article this week. The article itself is a little bit weird. It talks about, do patent firms help or hurt startups? I think if you thought about it logically, you could figure out they probably hurt. And guess what? That's what they determined here. But it might not be for all the reasons that you first thought. I guess first, let's just talk about patent trolls. It's a huge issue that's out there. It's one of the bigger issues in the legal field, something that they're trying to get legislation passed to prevent this from happening. But it's really just destroying smaller companies.
Yeah, I mentioned patent trolls last week, and I mentioned how a lot of people aren't even aware about these patent wars. But my wife told me apparently everyone knows, and so I'm wrong in that. But let's explain anyway. These patent firms, basically, they buy a bunch of patents from startups mostly or from smaller companies. And they use these patents to actually file a lawsuit against these other bigger companies in order to settle a lawsuit to basically, some would argue, extort money out of them. A lot of times these patents are, for example, everything from a touchscreen to multi-touch to any little small invention that goes into a cellular phone has been a product of a patent war. And so this article has kind of broken it down as to what's the real benefit of these patent firms. And patent firms, of course, are going to argue that, well, money is flowing to these startups, right? And so we're producing a market for these patents that otherwise wouldn't have any.
Yeah, but either way, even if these patent firms are helping out these smaller companies with patents, the businesses still have to spend money. So I think it's the more underlying issue of these bigger companies that are buying these patents or initiating litigation. It costs small companies a lot of money to enforce their IP that they have, and it's just a huge issue. But let me get a little more into the article. Something I didn't think about off the top of my head or think about it in the past. Obviously, there's a huge financial toll on being in litigation, but it mentions some non-financial aspects of it as well. And it's a good point that once companies get locked up in this litigation, they put off other things such as hiring new people. Maybe that prevents them from meeting goals for the end of the year. It talks about business line pivots and exits. But yeah, the author brings up a very good point that not just from the financial side, but these patent lawsuits, the patent trolls that are initiating them, are just destroying these small companies.
Well, let's just take the counter argument, for example, because I also think that these patent wars are inflated a little bit by bigger companies because those are the ones that are being hurt most by it. But what about the small business, right? I think the big problem with them is that even if they get a patent for something, they don't have the funds to defend it. And so therefore, it's pretty much worthless. So even if someone else is infringing upon your patent, what are you going to do about it? And so when a lot of our clients ask us, we want to spend some money to get some patents. And yeah, they're good to have, but not only are you going to spend $10,000+ just to get a simple patent, but if you actually have to enforce that, then it's going to be 10 times more of that in litigation. So I understand that patent wars are horrible for innovation, I think. And I think that's why a lot of the laws are being revised. But at the same time, sometimes it's just not cost effective as well to maintain a patent because you don't have the funds. You're trying to run your business.
Yeah, I think I've heard before they say that a patent's only as good as how much you can enforce it.
That's true. Yeah.
Something about intellectual property in general, but it's kind of true, especially in this situation.
No doubt. I think we should revisit that topic because intellectual property is something that we'll keep coming into. But I think there's some more development in the patent law that's going to be coming up in the next year.
Yeah, I agree. So I think this will not be the last time we talk about it. So I guess that Mark Cuban could not make it for today's podcast. He had a scheduling conflict. Mavericks game tonight. But
okay,
yeah. But I'm sure we can get it maybe after the NBA season and after the Shark Tank. And
well, you know, you're referencing Mark Cuban. Obviously, the reason you're mentioning is because he's a big proponent of patent reform, basically, and he's always been a opponent to these patent trolls, so-called. So good reference.
All right. So the first question this week is from a company in Modesto, California. Are digitally signed signatures legally binding?
Yeah, they are, pretty much. Otherwise, all those contracts we sign online would not be effective. But I think there's some certain requirements for each. I know every state's different. What are the requirements for California again?
The requirements in California, the signature is unique to the person using it. Is it capable of verification? Is it under the sole control of the person using it? Is it linked to data in such a manner that if the data are changed, the digital signature is invalidated and it conforms to regulations adopted by the Secretary of State?
That's for digital signatures, but I'm not sure if this person's asking specifically for, you know, a computer-generated mark. There's also exceptions. You can always put in your contract that, for example, in order to execute or to sign this agreement, then you can digitally sign it with a pen or make a copy of it or scan it in, and that may be just as effective as the original, in fact. So I'm not sure exactly what this person's asking, because digital signing may also be something more, this proves that you're the person that actually signed it. But I think also in common business, people use PDFs all the time, and that's a common place as well.
Right. And you see it all the time in a lot of different transactions with a lot of different industries. So I know I've done digital signatures and all sorts of different things. You know, each state has different laws. So this business is in California, so that's the rules for California. But I would just say that make sure to look into that, whatever state you're in, if someone's listening outside of California.
Well, also look at the contract that you're signing. And for those that are listening, you'll probably notice that as attorneys, we often put a clause towards the end that says something to the effect that a facsimile, a copy, or some other kind of scan is just as good as the original. And not only that, is duplicates, but also counterparts too. So if you have two contracts, one signed by one party, the other signed by the other party, that's still also enforceable just as the original, as if they were both signed.
I can almost guarantee a lot of people have encountered that before, but it's just they don't look to the miscellaneous or general provisions at the end of an agreement. So it's in those agreements that you've signed, but you just probably have never
noticed it.
If you get all the way to the miscellaneous or general provisions, and that's some good work reading through that contract.
Yeah, you've gotten farther than most people, even attorneys, frankly. I know a lot of attorneys that just skip the miscellaneous provision too, because you know, even though you, as an attorney drafter, you really shouldn't mess with it too much and put any substantial provisions in there, but sometimes it makes sense to put it in there and it gets missed.
Yeah. Let's get to the next article here. The article itself, the beginning of it wasn't really what I wanted to talk about, but it's Small Business Saturday shines at bookstores. I don't know how many bookstores even open anymore, so I guess I'd have to look into that, but I wanted to get more into Small Business Saturday, and it's really big for these independently owned smaller businesses.
It's November 30th, right? And this podcast, of course, is coming up 2 days later. So I hope you went to your small businesses on Saturday.
Yeah. If not, then wait next year and definitely utilize it. But so for every $100 spent at a local store, $68 stays in your community, as opposed to if you shop at a chain store, only $43 stays in the community. And surprise, surprise, if you shop online, virtually nothing stays in your community. That should not be any surprise, but
unless it's located in your town, the virtual store.
That's true. And this is a huge thing for small businesses, and it's part of this quote-unquote localism movement. But I've definitely noticed a lot more ads on TV. I think American Express has really pushed this stuff too.
Yeah, I didn't even know. Apparently, they're the ones that actually were the original engine behind starting it. I had no idea. I thought it was just kind of some kind of small business movement, but it took a big company like that to really make it happen.
Yeah, I'm a big supporter of independently owned businesses, whether it be stores, restaurants, anything like that. So I'll definitely be out on Saturday. I won't be in my home. Well, I guess I'll be in my original hometown, so I'll be supporting some of those smaller businesses. The thing that, and you'll understand this too, because I'll be back in Indiana, being in the Midwest or even the East Coast sometimes is worse. So these small companies are really hoping for a big day on this Saturday. If there's bad weather, that really decimates these businesses. So I'm really hoping that nationwide we get some good weather, because
it's true.
It's a huge day.
So you're going to Indiana for the holidays this weekend. That'll be fun.
For the people listening, you know, I had a great time. I'm already back in San Diego.
Bought a lot of stuff from small businesses.
Yeah, I got so much small business stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah, I'm going to try to figure out what I could do on Saturday to support my local businesses. That'll be fun.
Question two, and this comes from a wine owner in Temecula, California.
Wow.
If I start a company with a business partner, would my wife take over my share if I were to pass away? And I guess we're assuming that his business partner is not his wife, I would think.
Hopefully. Yeah. That's a good assumption. Well, there's a lot to talk about with that question, right? We have community property issues. So if you're in a state with community property, which many states are now, basically if you've obtained any property during the marriage, and this is the general rule, then that property is considered community property, unless it's by inheritance or a gift, other items as well. And so upon divorce, then it'll go to your spouse 50%. Then upon your death, well, it kind of depends, right, Matt? It depends upon whether you have a will or not and how that can work.
Yeah, this is a pretty loaded question. There's a lot of things that come into play. I mean, we could spend a ton of time just on the community property issue, but since there's multiple owners, hopefully there's some sort of buy-sell agreement in place. If it was properly drafted, that should cover pretty much what this question is asking. So it makes me think that this particular business owner does not have a buy-sell agreement. So that's the first thing I would say is get something set up. And then after that, yeah, like you said, community property, it depends on what type of proceeds were used to start up the company. So if it was separate property of them, then that's a different story than the community property.
Oh, that's true.
Other than that, you're going to want to look to the agreement. So let's assume it was an operating agreement or partnership agreement used to set up the company, stock certificates, if it's more of a corporation. But there's a lot of things to look at and a lot of things to consider.
Absolutely. And not only this person's asking, what if I pass away, but then there's all these other issues too in exits in general, in the sense that you have two people in a business. Now, what if one of them leaves, and what are all the reasons they could leave? And you have to make sure that you contemplate each of those. It could be involuntary by death, but also what happens if the person is just wants out, or the person is not pulling their weight anymore and you want to force them out? These are all things to contemplate in the very beginning that can be done through buy-sells, through members' agreements, and so forth. And you can get pretty creative as far as how you value the company and different triggers of when that occurs.
Yeah, it's not just death that you need to think about. There's a lot of triggering events that could pop up. So you want to make sure all those are covered. And I don't want to get too much into detail of buy-sell agreements, but valuation is a big issue. How and when and what method. Make sure you get something set up and some sort of agreement would be very helpful.
Absolutely.
So we'll take our little break here for this week. And I think we're going to do our first update that we've had from a previous article. This was in one of the first couple episodes, maybe the first one. I don't remember, but I know we talked about Arian Foster and we talked about the company that was going to take him public. I think it was $10 million for 20% maybe of his current and future earnings. Well, a few weeks ago, he got hurt, like we discussed in the original article. Running backs.
Yeah, he's a running back.
They're very likely to get hurt. And guess what? He got hurt and he's out for the year. So now Fantex, the company that was going to take him public, has held off on doing this offering here. So pretty much everything we discussed when we initially discussed the article seemed like a bad idea because it's easy for him to get hurt. I think it was a week or two later after we discussed it, he got injured. I think he got injured, came back, then got hurt again and was out for the year. So I just wanted to bring this up because we talked about it before. And they're even talking about doing another one for Vernon Davis for the 49ers, $4 million for 10% of his future earnings. But I mean, he's a little bit more durable because he's a tight end and he's pretty big and they don't get hurt as often. But still, it's football. You're having 300-pound guys, 250-pound guys that are huge running full speed at each other. Someone's going to get hurt.
Yeah, but your question is this any more risky than some of the other stock offerings available out there, right? Let's look at all the other IPOs that have gone through the last year, whether it's Facebook or Twitter. Some may argue that it's not much more riskier, so it's an interesting concept.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to bring this up again because we talked about it. I think it was in the first podcast. We'll get into our next article here.
This is the business plan in which in Houston, again, we're talking about Arian Foster right to Houston, so that's a nice transition.
Yeah, he's one Houston sport to another.
Exactly. So, well, what's interesting here is that we have some of the owners of the ball club that are being sued because they've... What?
You're discreetly describing sports as... I like when you recap the sports stuff.
That's true. Some kind of sport with balls and bats are with a company that plays games of sorts. That's true. I'm so not a sports guy, but that's okay.
That's all right.
All right. So, well, they're claiming that they lost tens of millions of dollars because of a business plan prepared by Comcast and also the former Astros owner, Drayton McLean, and Rockets owner Leslie Alexander.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, obviously in business plans, sometimes you have to just make projections. So it brings up the issue of what's the right way to go about those projections, conservative versus aggressive. It might be a little bit different here because this seems like it could be they're claiming fraud or misrepresenting things. So it might be a little bit different, but it kind of gets to the issue of how do you go about financial terms in a business plan?
Well, let's talk to Tyler Jensen. He's from Startup Garage, and I'm going to give him a call here in a second, but he actually has some sports background too as well. Let's get him on the line.
All right.
Hey, Tyler, this is Nasser Pasha. Is this Tyler Jensen from Startup Garage?
Yes, it is.
Very good. We also got Matt here. Say hello, Matt.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Matt.
So we were just looking over this article, and Matt and I were talking about some of your background, and I realized this article is perfect for you because you also have a sports background too, don't you?
I do. I founded Vavi Sport and Social Club back in 2001.
Well, very good. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what Startup Garage does and its relation to business plans, and I think that'll be helpful.
Yeah, well, we work with entrepreneurs who are looking to attract investment. And so we help those entrepreneurs and the startups they work with to accomplish the milestones that the investors care about. And one of those big milestones is the business plan. And so that's our primary thing that we help and work with entrepreneurs on is getting that all done and figured out and the business strategy that goes along with completing the business plan.
How do you work with those financials? Because this is what this article is talking about is obviously the claim is that the financials are bloated a little bit. And I think that's the toughest part when it comes to the business plan is coming up with those numbers and some conservative estimates.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a challenge and there's no magic answer to that. There are industry averages. One of the things that having done over 100 business plans at this point, bringing that kind of prior experience, having seen a bunch of other financials, that helps as well to see what's realistic and what's not.
Yeah.
And then having access to some databases that have those industry averages, that helps as well in building it. And so it's just about getting some assumptions that other businesses may have proven to be realistic and pass what we call the smell test. You know, you build it all and then you check it against what reality is. Is this really going to be able to happen?
So Tyler, have you ever come across a situation where maybe you've developed a business plan or helped someone develop a business plan and you're presenting it in front of someone and they just say, this doesn't look right at all. This is way too aggressive. The numbers are way too high. Have you ever come across a situation like that?
Well, I would answer that question this way. When you are presenting a business plan, no matter how well done and how much time you took to prepare it, you're always going to get different feedback. And what I have seen is that in the same meeting, if you're presenting to a group of different investors, you could have that response from a couple people and the exact opposite response from other people, that it's too conservative or not conservative enough. It ranges, and it ranges from everyone's different perspective. So it's really one of those things that there's really no right answer for. It's a lot of opinion because you're projecting the future.
Right.
It takes a lot.
When we advise our clients in regards to our business plans, and we don't get into too much detail with that, except when we're providing a PPM or a subscription agreement, for example, but when they're drafting the business plan, I tend to just say, make it as conservative as possible, because when you do get funded, you want to hit those numbers hard. And that way, you know, you prove some loyalty to your investors.
You know, I totally agree with that. And it's the same advice I give the clients that I work with. It's a lot easier when you're in a meeting with an investor to have them arguing that you should be making more money than you're saying, rather than them arguing that your numbers are too high. We want to kind of put yourself in a place that you're saying, well, yeah, of course we would love to do that more revenue that you're saying is possible, and we will do everything we can. We picked conservative numbers, and I think investors appreciate that too. Although I've seen it where the other mistake is you've just gotten too conservative, then you're just not an interesting investment. So you got to find that sweet spot in there, and I'd always go on a little bit more conservative side of that sweet spot is what I would recommend.
Well, very cool. You know, we have a question from our listeners, and I wasn't planning on having you on for this, but I was just looking at it, and it seems you might have some insight. Maybe we can give our legal answer to it, and then you can give from your experience how that goes, if you don't mind.
Okay, I'll do my best.
Go ahead, Matt.
All right, so the question is, and this comes from a tech firm in Manhattan Beach, California. I'm about to start a company. What is the best entity type if I plan on raising capital through investors?
So when I first saw this question, my immediate answer is that everyone always seems to say C corps. Investors are familiar with it. There's a lot of things you can do with that. But I feel that the other entities and other structures aren't given enough attention only because investors aren't familiar with it. And I think one of the biggest questions that I ask my clients is, okay, how do you want to handle your control? And I happen to have some clients that really want to maintain as much control as possible. Now, keep in mind, that's not going to be very good for other investors, but there are certain structures that I like more than others with that respect. For example, a limited partnership structure is my favorite, where you have the general partner as the entity, and that's where they own maybe 1% of the limited partnership, and then all the limited partners are the investors. And that's where the monetary interest is in. But then the 1% interest basically controls the whole limited partnership. Obviously, no S-corps. Investors aren't going to like that. But what do you think, Tyler? Is there any kind of trend that you're seeing as far as what investors like?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the response that I usually give is that, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to want, you know, the investors are going to have a lot of say in what type of entity. And so what I've seen a lot, it doesn't answer the question exactly, but what I've seen a lot is that no matter what structure you pick originally, that at the time of getting that kind of seed round of funding, a lot of times there's a conversion to a different entity,
right,
depending on what the investors want. And a lot of times that is your traditional Delaware C Corp, just because investors know it. When you're getting a big group of investors together, that's the one that they can all agree on. And there's not as much convincing of everyone, oh, this makes more sense for this deal. Just makes it all more easier to do that.
Well, that's great advice. Yeah, I think that's, we get this question pretty frequently. And I think some of the people asking just have the hopes of one day getting investors. But for the people that actually are going to get investors, I think that's, you know, that's just great advice. And especially from someone that's around it all the time.
Well, Matt, didn't you have somebody that told you that, oh, I've heard that the investors just choose your entity, so I'm just not going to do anything until then? What was that again?
I've gotten a couple people. You'll get things all around, all over the board, but I've had some people tell me, oh, well, you know, I've heard that I don't want to do any sort of entity formation because I was told that the investors are going to want to come in and clean house and do everything themselves, which probably isn't the best way to approach it, but... Tyler, have you ever heard anyone mention that to you before?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it does make some sense. However, there's a lot that needs to happen before you're actually going out and get an investor. And we're kind of being broad here. Each type of investor and round of investor has a little bit different advice. So, you know, at the highest level, you've got your friends and family rounds, then you've got your angels, and then you've got your VCs and other types of larger rounds. And I would say different things for different types of funding. Also, the advice is different whether it's a small business or a high growth company where you're going to get multiple rounds of funding. If you can wait, then I would say, you know, wait. It's probably not, you know, what the lawyer wants to hear.
No.
But, that only really works if you're the only person in the business. If you have any partners or founders or, you know, anything like that, it just, you need a legal structure even before you're taking on funding because it's just too confusing and there's too many people are trying to put money in and they got to figure out what that money's worth. And there's just too many details that need to be worked out that you need to at least get some sort of structure set up initially. And you can always convert later or just start it right away with something that investors would like if that, you know, you're gonna, that's going to happen very soon.
Well, you know what, Tyler, I said no, but you're absolutely right in that, in the sense that if you're a sole proprietor and you're bootstrapping your business, sometimes incorporating too early is merely a distraction. But you're right also that if you have any partners, any kind of significant investment from outside, then I'd be careful about not having that entity, not only for liability purposes, but understanding who owns what and how much and making sure those agreements are in place. And you're right, it is confusing. And I understand, I love the lean startup model. And that means getting rid of the legal budget if you need to, but also knowing when to spend money as well.
Yep, totally agree.
Well, very good, Tyler. I really appreciate your attendance to our podcast this week. And we'll put up a link to your website, which I believe is startupgarage.com.
Exactly.
Very cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you guys. Good chatting with you.
Thanks, Tyler.
Thanks. Okay, so that was Tyler Jensen. Very good. You know, that was the second Tyler we've had on our podcast. I just realized that.
Yeah, no, we're going to have to find another Tyler for next week. I thought he offered really good advice.
Until he said, don't hire any attorneys ever. Yeah. Or no, he didn't say that exactly, but.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But no, he was actually making a good point. I mean, he's coming from the perspective, he's dealing with startup companies that are starting out, building a business plan. And the question is, okay, do I need an attorney to set up an entity? Well, maybe not right away. And, you know, setting up an entity has its cost in itself, whether it's the $800 franchise fee tax or the filing fee and so forth. And that might be too much for a business that is really bootstrapping.
Right. He had more overlap than I thought he'd have with us. Some startup people just don't like attorneys from the outset, but I think he's been around enough startups that have made it that he understands the value. Yeah, exactly what you said. It doesn't always make sense right away. So we'll leave that out there.
And I forgot to mention that raising capital through VCs or venture capitalists is a whole different thing than raising capital through friends and family or even other serial investors as well. It's just a different mentality. If VCs are investing in startups versus investors investing into a business that's been around for a while are two different things. And he made that point as well. It really depends on the situation.
It's different for most people. All of my family and friends are VCs, actually. So it's the same for me.
Yeah, sometimes there's overlap there. It's the same.
Yeah. All right, let's get into the last article here. Another article that's more pertinent a few days before people are going to be listening to this. But it talks about Black Friday discounts. Are they for real? And talks about a few lawsuits that are springing up about people, I'm assuming class actions that are brought, but suing some of these bigger companies. I think the one mentioned here is, there's a couple, JCPenney's, Kohl's, Jose Bank, but it's possibly fake sales. So for example, let's say you buy something for $20 and you think it's on sale, marked down 50%. But if you went in the store, you know, a week or two before, it's the same price. It just seems like it's on sale, but it's really not. And I would say this is misrepresentation.
Well, the FTC says it is. They say it's misleading, or in fact, if the higher price was offered to the public on a regular basis for a reasonable substantial period of time, that they consider it deceptive. I appreciate that. It seems like that's the basis for this lawsuit. But at the same time, like I'm kind of annoyed about these companies that are trying to gain an advantage under those circumstances.
Yeah, I guess businesses are trying to do what they think they have to do. But this actually reminds me of something I heard once. I think this is more of a negotiation discussion, but it was a jewelry store. And I forget how much the item was. Let's say it was $1,000. And they just couldn't sell this piece of jewelry. And so the owner was talking to one of the staff people. They say, hey, mark it down half off. You know, maybe we can sell it that way. And the person misheard it and actually doubled the price of the item. And someone came in that day and bought it because they perceived the value was a lot more than what they thought, which I guess is the exact opposite of this. But
yeah,
it kind of goes to, what do you value the items at? I think that's what I would say with this is, you know, if I value this article of clothing at $17.99, then I think that's fine. But these businesses are still doing something wrong with fake sales. That's my take.
Well, JCPenney, it's interesting that they're involved in one of these lawsuits is because they've been trying to figure out what to do for a while now. And I think one thing that they did maybe a couple years ago, I don't know if they got rid of it or not because I don't think it was successful, is they got rid of all their coupons and sales and just marked their prices lower. And for whatever reason, the people that shopped there didn't receive it very well. And I think they did it even worse. And so it seems like they're just taking advantage of the psychology of the consumer I'm sure there's a lot of market research on how these prices work and so forth. And I'm sure they've done a study that if you mark up the price beforehand and then mark it even more down later, it's going to make a bigger impact on that Black Friday.
Yeah, this would have been good to have our Tyler from last episode on to get his take on this, because it gets into marketing stuff. But it also reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever been to, for some reason, it seems to be sushi places. I've been to a few sushi places that'll say everything half off every single hour of every day that we're open. It's like, well, why don't you just make that the price?
I went to a sushi joint that had a grand opening and a certain percentage off, and their grand opening lasted, I'm pretty sure, 2 years. So I don't know if it's still going on, but
yeah, it's all the perception of the consumer. And I also think it's kind of funny how these people that are out on Black Friday are obviously trying to get sales, some of which are waking up really early, standing in long lines, dealing with stampedes coming in. And then they're also getting involved in lawsuits, which is one of the worst ways to spend money.
Save money, yeah. Well, that's our show, right? This is episode number 75.
Yeah.
No. What?
Or seven. What episode? Lucky number seven.
Or seven. And this will be airing after all these articles are no longer relevant. Next, we'll hear Arian Foster's IPO goes public and just, you know, get bit on that.
This isn't a live podcast? I thought people were streaming this.
And listen next week when we have another guest named Tyler, hopefully.
Yeah. Let's remind them to, if they have their own question, they can send them in to ask@legallysoundsmartbusiness.com. And we'll keep you anonymous, maybe say what type of business you're in and where you're located so we can answer it the most accurately as we can.
Yeah, send us both, because sometimes we just get the location, but it's good to know what kind of business you're in. This is Legally Sound Smart Business. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been the Legally Sound Smart Business Show with your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub. The Legally Sound Smart Business Show is your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Legally Sound Smart Business is a podcast that is intended but not promised or guaranteed to be current, complete, or up to date, and should in no way be taken as an indication of future results. No attorney-client relationship is created by listening or submitting questions to the podcast. The podcast does not constitute legal advice, but rather is offered only for general informational and educational purposes. You should not act or rely on any information in the podcast without first seeking the advice of an attorney. The opinions expressed in the podcast reflect the views of those individuals and do not necessarily represent the views of any other individual or business. For more information about the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, visit legallysoundsmartbusiness.com.
For those of you listening, you'll probably notice that as attorneys, we often put a clause towards the end that says something to the effect that a facsimile, a little embarrassing pronunciation there. That's okay. You still there, Matt?
Yeah. Sorry. This is a delay. We're going to have to cut this out. My Google dropped for a minute and everything went bad.
Okay.
And we're back. All right.
Hold on. Time out. My cat keeps meowing, so I gotta figure out, like, give her food or something. Sorry. 1 second. Chris is gonna have a fun time editing.
Yeah,
this one.
Writing down the things, the little blips we're having here. So I'll put him in the email.
Maybe he can, maybe he can leave some of this in to make it a little bit more humorous, but don't put too much of it in.